You know, I'm going to bring up the email that I sent you because I want to make sure that I liked what I sent you guys. So I want to make sure.
Fair.
I was like, that guy, so smart.
Hello and welcome to Snark Squad Pod, a media podcast full of friendship, feelings, and snark. I'm Nicole Sweeney.
My name is Marines.
And today we are joined by Eric Silver.
Hi, I'm Eric Silver. I am America's premier smart house expert. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. This is the wrong podcast. I'm sorry. I am Eric Silver. I am the head of creative and Multitude Productions. I am the dungeon master of Join the Party. I am the co-host of Horse, a basketball podcast that is actually just about internet stuff. And not actually about basketball. And I am a recreational competitive eater.
Eric is here this week to do, as the title of this episode that you probably already saw in your feed suggests, a definitely not an interview. Eric and I are mostly Twitter friends, a bond that grows stronger whenever I tweet about reality TV. I feel like that is now like the crux of our Twitter friendship, is just talking about reality TV and why we need to do a Snark Squad Pod episode about reality television.
Listen, the sooner that you start drinking, and the sooner that the next season of The Challenge starts, we can actually get that going.
In order to do that, we have to get Mari on board with the idea of a reality TV episode. So until then, I decided to have Eric join us as our third guinea pig in this, I don't know, format where we talk to our friends about their media preferences and quirks. So I ultimately want to ask you 1,000 questions about reality TV to force Mari to have another reality TV centric conversation.
And then Mari's just gonna sit there
and silence and the entire time. I'll join back in for the outro.
But before we get to all of that, what is your go-to media? What do you spend the most time consuming?
Okay, that's a great question. Now, Mari, before we get into all this, I promise you, it's not reality television. Uh-huh. It is reality TV competitions.
Okay.
So it is shows. The difference between Vanderpump Rules and Survivor, let's say. Okay. So I would say my favorite piece of media right now are podcasts. I do love movies and TV, but I'm actually drawn to this larger idea of things with rules and seeing how people play within them and play outside of them. So this could be genre rules or archetype rules. Or it could be literal games and sports. I'm a huge, huge games person. And I'm just like attracted to the way that people set up how to win them and then necessarily how to rip them apart to make yourself like a legend within that game. There are rules for making a book into an adaptation. Like, what are they? How much are they adapting to the actual source text? And then what do they break? So I super love the Umbrella Academy, which was adhering to what does it look like to do something that is outside of the DC Marvel universe and make a comic book adaptation. Mm-hmm. That also extends to sports. It extends to reality TV. But I mean, to answer your question directly, any given night, you will see me curled up on the couch with my headphones on, listening to a podcast and playing my Switch.
Multitasking. I like that.
You got to do everything at the same time. I think that's why I love podcasts so much, because it only requires one sense. And I'm like, oh, I have so many other things I can do with my eyes.
I kind of want to take it back from there, because now I'm curious about like the evolution to current Eric, because I don't imagine that you were like, 6 years old listening to podcasts. So
I got super early on the Radio Lab. I was like,
back in the day, what was some of your formative media? Like, where did you start? Where did your taste start that kind of led you to this point?
I think there are two things that really stood out to me when I was a kid. I super loved sitcoms. I think I like the idea of being funny and then someone directly laughing at it. And like,
yes.
So it's like if you grow up and wanting to be a Chandler, that shapes your life quite specifically. So I kind of like the idea. And when I was watching Friends, which I had this like 3-hour block on TBS, and then later How I Met Your Mother and other sitcoms like that, it was more like being aware of the character being funny within space, even if they didn't say something that was like would make someone in the room that was like laugh. Like, there was a lot, like Chandler on Friends was very mean. He was a very mean person. He wasn't a very good friend unless he really needed to be and like access his emotions. But he would say mean things to other friends, and then like the laugh track would laugh. And I was like, oh, I understand, because he's doing something that is funny in the situation, but is not necessarily funny to everybody around him. And I thought that was really interesting. I also had, I was a voracious reader when I was a kid. I loved video games, but I had a twin brother. So I feel like a lot of that stuff was like a shared experience between us two. And you can only like beat, I could only beat him in Super Smash Brothers so many times before it got like to be a big deal. to keep my attention. And, I also, I went to summer camp in the wilds of Canada. So I always had a ton of books that I would like read and reread. And like, I would go up with my with like five books and then just like end up reading them multiple times over the summer. So I have this really distinct memory of reading Will Grayson, Will Grayson by John Green and David Levithan. And that was also one of the first books when I was like, oh, you can do this? Like, it's not just one person telling a story. You can, like, do weird shit also. Mm-hmm. And even now, and now thinking back on it, I was like, I kind of love it that the two main characters in Will Grayson and Will Grayson, like, are super lame. And they're like, fabulous gay friend slash boyfriend was, like, the best person in the book. And I thought, whose name is Tiny, which I just loved incredibly. And I was like, oh, that's so interesting that you're telling a story that's centered on you, but like the most dynamic character is your friend. And like, I realized it was kind of centered as like a manic pixie dream gay boy, but still, I mean, the fact that Will Grayson and Will Grayson were both kind of boring was also kind of interesting to me.
The self-awareness that maybe I am also kind of boring, a feeling that I often have.
Two different writers realized that their main character was fine, and they were sharing the plot, which was this amazing character who would traipse about in their stories, and I kind of love that.
The thing that I am struck by listening to you talk about all of this, just at like the basic, you know, what is the media that you're into, how cohesive your sense of your media preferences is. And I find that really interesting. And I'm curious, like, when did you notice this pattern that like structure was a thing that was driving your media interests?
I was a high school English teacher for a year. So I think I got really good at being able to like explain myself to other people, especially people who didn't really care, and doing it in an engaging way. And it might also be like, I spend a lot of time being like, oh, you don't get fundamentally what I'm talking about, so I need to reverse engineer it. And it might also be about podcasting. I mean, podcasting is relatively niche as well. And being able to explain what's going on in your field, especially now as everything is going bonkers in podcasting. But to that end, I think part of that is realizing that stories have structure just like games do, which all comes from Dungeons and Dragons, which I'm the dungeon master of a D&D podcast. And I've been telling the story over 50 episodes now. And I realize how much cause and effect, and it's conflict and cause and effect tell stories. And like Dungeons and Dragons facilitates that by putting physics, like really literal game physics around it to enable you to tell stories. So I think that that's when I started being aware of like, oh, everything has rules, everything has structure. And what's interesting is how people stay within those lines or subvert them to creative effect. I couldn't put my finger on it, but going in NYU, I knew a lot of hipsters and fucking artistic people who were just like subversive just to be subversive, and I hated them. But I realized that the reason it's like you have to break a rule. If you're going to break a rule, you have to make sure to do it for a reason. Mm-hmm. Well, are you doing it for creative effect? Are you doing it for shock value? I mean, that is a reason, I guess. Are you doing it because you think that the rules are stupid and you want to show other people why they're stupid? But you need to make sure you have a why if you're going to break a rule.
Hearing you talk about like the way that you enjoy structure, but I think you keep coming back to this idea of like playing with structure and for reasons and all of that. But do you have any examples of other media that you enjoy that subverts or breaks rules or does something a little bit different within its medium or genre that you really appreciated?
Oh, 100%. I think that the movie that stands out to me that does that is Scott Pilgrim versus the World. So you have like a lot of different structure happening at the same time. So first, it is a comic book that was adapted into a movie. So that, and then, but the comic book is majority based on video game references and structure. So how do you convey video games in a movie? And then how do you adapt the comic book-y-ness of those graphic novels? into a movie, and they held on to so much of that. And then like there were it's a great cast. Like Michael Cera is really good. Aubrey Plaza is in it. Chris Evans is in it. The Culkin, who I love, who's on Succession, is in it. Kieran Culkin, he's great. It's just like they hold on to so much video game-ness, and I'm like, oh, you can do this in a movie. You can do all of the video game things that I love. Like when you kill someone in the movie or in the comic book, in the graphic novel, like they burst into coins, and it's in Canada, so it's all loonies and toonies, and I'm like, that is the single funniest thing I've ever heard in my life. So it's being able to hold on to the things that you love about one medium and then putting it into another medium, and then for a third time putting it into another medium. And I really like that. I've seen Scott Pilgrim probably at least 10 times.
It is interesting to me that 10 is a high-end number for you. Because
I realized that as I said that out loud.
When I think of the things that I reconsume a ton of, which, like, I'm not a huge reconsumer except for, like, the five or six things that I do. And I'm like, cool, this is it. This is all this is what I do now. I just read this book over and over again. So, in general, do you consider yourself somebody who reconsumes things, or are you more in the, like, no, there's so much new stuff?
Oh, definitely in the latter category. I realized that as soon as I said it. I'm like, 10 is not a high number to these people who have a media podcast.
I think, no, specifically, like, me more than Nicole. I reconsume everything. Nicole reconsumes her favorites. So I don't think this is a you thing. I think that just it's Nicole and I, we both kind of like, 10 times.
10 times. Sure.
Yeah. You guys just messaged each other while not, I'm like, wow, only 10 times.
And he calls that a favorite.
Yeah, well, what is it that y'all reconsume? Like, are we talking movies, or are we talking TV shows? Are we talking, Nicole, you said books?
Books. There's like a couple books that I reread the His Dark Materials books every year. Routinely fall asleep listening to the Rosamund Pike Pride and Prejudice audiobook because it's soothing. So there's that. Mostly it's TV shows and movies. Like Veronica Mars, I have, like, the first three seasons I've seen a ridiculous number of times. I have purchased but never consumed anything that comes after the third season of Veronica Mars. I just am like, cool, like, I own the movie, I like own the books, but I'm not interested in that. I'm just interested in watching the show again. Pride and Prejudice, the Keira Knightley movie, came out when I was in high school, and the DVD, I bought that DVD, and for, I don't know, a whole semester, basically, I came home from school every day and put that DVD on, and I would just watch it. It was like, it was on in the background. I don't know, like, how closely was I watching it? I'm not entirely sure, but I definitely watched that DVD every single day for, I don't know, months.
That's fair. I get putting TV, something that is on a screen, on in the background, but I just, like, I can't get myself necessarily to rewatch a movie unless, like, I have a very good reason and I really want to and I want to look back at it. For example, I saw Hobbs and Shaw twice in 2 weekends. because the first time I wanted to see it with Amanda, which I saw immediately. We just moved in together last weekend, and it was just like a huge, like, we had all this stress on us, and we're like, we're going to Hobbs and Shaw, and this is happening. And it was the weekend that it came out, so I made sure to do it. And then I saw it with my friends this weekend, and I'm like, this movie was so ridiculous, I need to see it with my friends, and there are things about it that I need to, like, redigest because I know are ridiculous, and I need to be able to, like, think about it later. So I had I was like, this movie is ridiculous and I need to see the ridiculous parts again. But, like, I don't necessarily want to put anything on in the background. The thing that I put on in the background are podcasts mostly. Mm-hmm. And I put on, like, non-sequential, like, I can't put, like, a fiction podcast on that has, like, a...
Right, there's a through line that you have to be tracking.
Exactly. Like, I need discrete episodes that are funny and, like, light and not something I necessarily need to pay attention to, because I use podcasts to fall asleep a lot. Mm-hmm. I just, like, something about I have like rationalized sleep in a way that I'm like, it's weird that your body passes out when you need it to. So I think about that too much. So I need to be doing something else, and then sleep gets behind me and does a sneak attack on me. So
This is now going to be added to the list of reasons I can't sleep. Shit.
Sorry to everyone who's consuming this, my bad.
It's funny because part of the reason that I reconsume media, like I like to do it. It's part of the way that I like learn how to pick media apart. And maybe my brain, I feel like probably isn't as good as yours, say, at picking up patterns and structures and things like that. But if I reconsume, I can, and it becomes a little easier for me to like notice those things. But another portion of it is because I do have anxiety brain, and reconsuming kind of turns off a piece of that if I know what's going to come, if I know what to expect. And I feel like falling asleep listening to audiobooks or watching a movie that I've seen a lot of times, if I'm feeling down or stressed or whatever, does something to my brain that kind of soothes the anxiety.
Sure. Yeah, and I 100% agree with that. And I feel like maybe it seems like I'm putting on a better face than I am, because I do the same thing, because I just consume thing. Maybe it's just a larger genre and it's the things with rules. Yeah. But that can go as far as what, like Chopped on one side and MTV's The Challenge on the other side. They all have rules. It's a game. Someone wins at the end, but the genre is just so far apart, or the traditional like TV genre is so far apart. It looks like I'm worldly.
This anxiety conversation is interesting because it reminds me of conversations that we have had many times about spoilers. And I think it is through having these conversations that it became clear to me that part of why I am like nonchalant about spoilers is that anxiety thing. Is like, there is a part of me that's like, no, it's better for me if I just know, and then I can be looking for it, I can be ready for it. It satisfies my brain in a similar way to reconsuming in certain occasions, not all occasions, but to have things spoiled in that way. And I'm curious how you feel about spoilers in general. Are you like sensitive about them? Is it something that you ever seek out? Are you just ambivalent?
I do care about them because I think, as you said, I'm not really a rewatcher of movies or large TV shows. So I do want to be surprised about what comes next, like following it. But there is one thing that I definitely spoil myself on all the time, because I will never go watch it or see it, and that's horror movies. So I'm team read Wikipedia pages of horror movies till I die, which is like having a resurgence, which I love. Like, it's a thing that people talk about now, and I'm like, oh, I've been doing that forever. That's great. And when we talk about rules, when we talk about story structure, horror movies are so interesting to me, because it's like, all right, this is going to be the same movie you've seen every other time, and there's a monster, and there are going to be jump scares, and just focus on being scared because you know what's going to happen no matter what. And I'm like, oh, that's so interesting. And then, of course, when people push up against those rules, as literally demarcated by the Scream franchise, where Seth Green walks around and tells you the movie, the rules of horror movies, it's like, then people get as wild as fuck about what they can do when they tell stories, horror movie stories. So then I love watching. So like being able to watch, this is like a renaissance of buck wild horror movies. Being able to read the Wikipedia pages of Get Out, Us, Midsommar, Saw, The Babadook, It Follows, all of those, I'm like, oh, fuck yeah. I would love this if I didn't hate horror it. Movies all 100%.
I would love this if I didn't hate it. Yes. Yeah,
exactly. Yes. 100% correct.
It's interesting to me to also hear you talk about like the structures and rules, because in a lot of ways for fiction pieces or whatnot, those are our tropes that the story uses. Mm-hmm. So are there any tropes that you can like pinpoint and say like these are ones that I really like?
Oh man. I think I love the Fast and Furious franchise because they lean so hard on the found family trope.
Yeah,
because it's like, we all say it's the friends we found along the way were the meaningful thing. But like seeing Vin Diesel look at me in the eyes and being like, it's about family. I'm like, yes, it is. This car movie is about family.
This is great because we're gonna move into reality TV, I'm sure, which is not my cup of tea. But the Fast and Furious movies are my my cup of tea. And I don't know, for the past like 3 or 4 episodes of this podcast, we've found a way for me to mention that Nicole needs to watch all of these movies.
How often Nicole! This has come up in the last few weeks. I'm starting to feel like other people are being planted. Like she's paying people off.
I'm gonna we're all in like the podcast Camp David, and I'm brokering peace between the two of you. Mari, just watch the challenge. And Nicole, for God's sakes, watch Furious 5.
Good. But yes, found family is something that we talk about on the podcast all the time because Nicole and I both love that trope as well.
Yeah, but like I kind of like it when like you're pushing on it super hard. And I mean, coming from a Dungeons and Dragons and fantasy perspective, I'm like, oh, wow, look at these 5 orphans who all decided to hang out and become heroes together. I'm like, I guess. If you say so. So I kind of like the idea of like pushing on it super hard and being very overt about it. And it really gives this buck wild action movie a lot of heart. Maybe if it's not exactly earned, but it's like they lean on it so hard that it really becomes a big deal. So maybe it's about pushing that trope to its limit is why I like that found family stuff just as much. This is going to be like so ridiculously specific, but I like new properties that remix traditional properties and use their archetypes that are like copyrighted, but then like you see them remake it in a new way to like fill out their entire world. So like I like plays within plays. I like books that are only found in movies. Like the idea of the game, the board game Jumanji is super interesting to me. Mm-hmm. I'm like, how do you play the game Jumanji? or like video games. This new thing they're doing on the new DuckTales reboot is that Darkwing Duck is a show within DuckTales, and I love that. I think it's so interesting that like they're taking a show and making it into a show in the show. And I think that this is also incredibly prevalent in superhero TV shows and comic books that are outside of the big two, outside of Marvel and DC properties. So there's like all of these books that I've read that are about thinking about superhero stuff and turning it into a novel, but you can't use like Spider-Man. So you have to use the archetypes that all of these people represent. Like you can't make a Batman, but you do want to make someone who like doesn't have traditional powers and is very moody and like uses a dark animal. But like think about Watchmen in that way, like something that stands out and be like, oh, I know like Rorschach is supposed to be this fucked up guy and Ozymandias is supposed to have all the money. And I thought that was really interesting. But there are some contemporary books like that, like The Regional Office is Under Attack is an amazing book like that. Soon I Will Be Invincible is also an amazing novel that flips from the villain's perspective and a new recruit who's like a cyborg woman because she was in like a terrible accident and like a shady corporation like remade her into a cyborg and made her like 7 feet tall. Super wild. And then there's like a game that I really like called Sentinels of the Multiverse, which is it's like a fixed card game. Like imagine you were playing Magic the Gathering, but someone gave you the deck and it was themed around a specific superhero. And it's like it's a cooperative game that you play against like a villain and environment. Super interesting. But it's like you keep seeing all of these like reproduced comic book archetypes that are like churned out as different people and have different names and like have different branding. And like, what does their suit look like? What are their powers? I love the idea of the character creation that comes when you're within a traditional archetype.
Somewhat related to all of this, but I just want to do like a quick plug for a friend of the podcast, Taylor Simons, whose first novel came out earlier this summer, and it's also set in a superhero universe. It's not quite the same as some of the things that you're describing, but it's similar in that so her like twist on it is that the protagonist is not a superhero and she like hates superheroes, but then she finds like the book, like the inciting incident is that she like finds a dead superhero and is like, oh no, now I guess I have to like save the annoying superheroes. Similar sort of, you know, playing with the space and the universe.
Yeah. Oh my God. Immediately I'm all like, what are their powers? What are their names? I need to know. What is their domain?
Taylor Simons, Collateral Damage. You know, that's my little recommendation there.
I will also recommend to you, I don't know if you've ever read it or heard of it, but Catherine M. Valenti's The Refrigerator Monologues. So basically it's a woman has died and is basically in hell. And in hell, she finds like a group of other women who are also been fridged in superhero stories, and they like make this group and sit down to tell their stories. But again, she can't use proper names, so she'll refer to like the Batman wannabe as the leather jock emo fuck Muppet, and like so things like that. But it's each of their like hero stories, but through the eyes of the women that were fridged because of them. So it's really, really great, and she's an amazing writer. So I recommend that one for you as well.
Mari gets double points because that novel has a ridiculous structure, and I need to jump from different characters within their each respective monologue. So there you go.
I also, I just wanted to say too that I read and loved Soon I Will Be Invincible. I've never met anybody else who has read that book, and it is amazing, phenomenal. So if anybody is listening and you want to check it out, I recommend that one too. I loved it.
I'm also a sucker for that because Austin Grossman used to be a video game designer. So I kind of saw like the way that the story was playing out, the way that like each villain or like each scene was like a stage in a video game, and it was his first novel, so I saw how he leaned really hard into that. So I love that. Yeah, I mean, everyone else likes his
brothers,
the other book about video game design more, but like I really like Soon I Will Be Invincible.
I thought you were going to mention his brother. Now I can't remember.
Oh,
his
Lev
first
Grossman
name.
Yes, can rest on his magician laurels. He doesn't need my plug.
Well, no, I thought you were going to mention and say something like everybody likes Lev Grossman's books. I just wanted to say that they're trash and I hate them. But anyways,
get them.
Read Austin Grossman instead.
Well, speaking of, you know, people shooting their shot at like trashing things, I do know, Eric, we asked you in advance to like be prepared to talk about some stuff that you like really hated, really didn't like, and your list did include a book, so you want to share that with the class, Eric. Share your feelings.
Oh, fuck. All right. I got to, like, limber up. Like, holy shit. Yeah, I super hate The Name of the Wind series by Patrick Rothfuss. It took me a really long time to read it, but I knew of Patrick Rothfuss just as, like, this novelist, because he would pop up on Dungeons & Dragons content. So, like, the company that owns Dungeons & Dragons, Wizards of the Coast, has, like, pushed really, really hard into, like, making streams and podcasts and stuff like that, like internally. And Patrick Rothfuss is always someone who they can pick because, oh, he's a novelist and he's creative and he pops up and he's like supposed to be a feminist, like, I guess, I don't know. So that he always pops up and he's like supposed to be this like capital G, capital B good boy. And then I'm like, all right, maybe I should read this novel. And I had gotten really nice, good recommendations for it because there's a lot of really good world building. And there is. Patrick Rothfuss spends a ton of time talking about like the structure of the like landscape of the country, like going to different cities. It all revolves around a university. And like, I understand the way that people teach magic at the university. I have a pretty good idea of how like economics work at the university. I know how the magic has like a super rooted in elements and like it's more like science than it is magic. Like, congratulations. But like, fuck you, Patrick Rothfuss, for pretending to be a feminist and like deciding to put in like all of the terrible tropes of fantasy when people are heralding you as like the next J.R.R. Tolkien. There's a part in the second book where the hero, whose name is Quoth, who's supposed to be like a fantasy Romani, so like who's discriminated against, but they don't have dark skin, they have red hair, so like literally fuck yourself. And like they're all bards and they're musical, and Quoth is like the smartest and like most accomplished person of all time, and like he's clever, he's the kind of guy who doesn't have to study and get straight A's, like that kind of guy, to like the extreme, but like with magic and like saving the world from capital E evil. But there is a part in the second book where Quoth saves two women from sex slavery when people are posing as the bard quasi fantasy Romani people. They're like posing as them, but they're really slavers. So he saves them, and one of the women like spits on the ground and like curses all men for what they've done to her, almost being indentured into sex servitude, or sexual indenturement. And he literally says, quote, he literally says, not all men. And I'm like, what are we doing here? here. There's another part where Quoth is a virgin, but he's so, but then he like has sex with the god of love in like the world and is like super good at it. And it goes on for like 100 pages.
Oh goodness.
I straight up skipped it. It had very little bearing on the plot.
So I this is really funny. I've read The Name in the Wind years ago now, and I really enjoyed it. However, well, okay, so the same kind of thing. I think that this, like, on paper, this is a book that, like, should go be right up my alley and your alley, especially with what you're talking about, like the structure and the world building. I love that it's like a story within a story, and the way that it's framed with Kvothe kind of telling us that he, you know, telling us what has already happened, but in a way where we're not sure why he's telling the story and who he is now and what's happened. So that kind of framing of the story is something that I super love. I love stories within stories.
Yes, but I will say, thinking back on it, and I agree with you, I do like the structure and the fact that it's like a bard is telling the tale, but it's like in a video game when like the tutorial is an hour and you're like, yeah, I get how to play the game, like can we just go to the game?
The thing that I think I was left feeling like most strongly at the end, and I wrote this in like a review or something, took it somewhere online, was basically about the main female characters and how icky I felt about you know, Patrick Rothfuss and his portrayal of his female characters, and specifically the main female love interest was really weird, and I couldn't pinpoint why. And everybody was writing me back saying, oh, just wait till the second book, wait till the second book, wait till the second book. And I that made me never want to read the second book, so I never did. And I like never went back to that book or the world again, because everybody had warned me off in a way that made me feel like maybe I should not read the second book.
Just leave it alone.
Wait, do they say that the second book was better?
Worse.
Really? Because I would say like the second book is when like the heroics start. The first part is like Quoth is like a fucking Mark Twain pauper for like the first half of it, and then he like breaks into the school by being super smart. Like I thought like the world is pretty established in the second one. That's wild. I'm so surprised, and like I 100% agree with it. It's just like that's like the worst of the problems is that Quoth is a Mary Sue, and like all the female characters are one-sided.
This is also a like super niche, I guess, reaction to all of this, but I'm really excited to hear how the Discord, the Snarker Squad Discord reacts to this episode.
The entire Discord that everyone's on.
Because many people kept pushing for Name of the Wind to be one of our book club picks. But I would like to now pivot to something else that you mentioned that you hated, because this was a surprise to me. The other thing that you told us is that you have a lot of problems with the Chef's Table series on Netflix. And this is like, your Patrick Rothfuss issues. Like, I'm like, okay, I get it. I mean, I truly, like, I don't know anything about it, but I had not realized that one could have a hot take about the Chef's Table series on Netflix. Eric, please give me your Chef's Table hot take.
So this is the thing. This is what I was saying before, is like me trying to explain myself to other people. I've gotten pretty good at it. So Chef's Table, what it is it should be a documentary about a chef making innovative food and looking at that food and where that food comes from them as a person. Drop like 100%. The camera work, the cinematography is amazing. I love food media so incredibly much. But it's like someone told them, it's like, all right, well, it seems cool. I mean, like cool drones and like I like the cameras you're putting on that pasta, but like you got to have a story. And I was like, okay, fine. So you go up to you pick the chefs who are the most brilliant chefs, you know, who have the most technique. And you're like, hey, do you have like a story? Is there something cool about your life? And they're like, yeah, I mean, I guess like I kind of was a fuck up when I was like 20 to 23. And like, great, we're going to talk about that. And that's going to be the structure of the entire episode. So it's like they're putting the idea of like a documentary narrative that needs to have like redemption and is usually tragic in some sort of way. And they're really trying to squeeze all of it and putting it onto these chefs who don't actually have it. And a lot of these stories come down to the fact that it's like the chef was like, yeah, I grew up in Westchester County, New York. And like my dad worked, but my dad had a really good job. And my mom stayed at home. My grandma taught me some recipes. And then like when I was 17, I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And then my dad told me to go work at a sushi restaurant. And now I only make Asian food. And I went to Japan for a while and it really opened my eyes. And then it's like, wow. And it's that's like the worst. There's like some specific examples that really get me. There's one where like a guy was like a big shot chef in New York City, and then his restaurant like failed, and then he just like escaped to I can't even remember, because it's like they didn't really focus on it, but it was like a Pacific Asiatic island somewhere that has like, it seems beautiful, but definitely has like a vacation, is like a tourist attraction in that way. And he's like, yeah, now I just live here and I just make food and like I have a restaurant. And I'm like, you just escaped New York City and now you're appropriating this entire country for your just cause. The one that really bothers me the most is the one about Christina Tosi, who is this amazing pastry chef who started Milk Bar in New York City. And there was a lot of stuff about how she fell in love with desserts, and she is a traditionally attractive woman. She's white, she has blonde hair, she's from the Midwest. So there was a lot of talk in the beginning about how like it was cool for everyone to just like eat cake and ice cream and sugar all the time. And I'm like, that's a weird thing to tell other people who definitely don't have that experience. And then the middle chunk was how she was working her ass off, and she was working for all these different restaurants, these famous chefs. And then like David Chang, who is another famous chef, just like took all the credit and like found her and like, yeah, she loaned me out from Wiley Dufresne because my back of house and like my finances were totally fucked. And like, she just loaned me her to me. And then I discovered her, and like, I gave her all of the push and all of the energy and all of the support and the money to go make Milk Bar eventually. And I'm like, the way that you're telling this story makes David Chang seem like he's the focus of this story instead of Christina Tosi. And then like the last third is just like, Milk Bar is great. And like, I tried my best and like, I worked really hard on it and I made some weird ice cream. And then ta-da, I'm Christina Tosi and I'm on MasterChef. She was so good on MasterChef. I loved her. And like, I respect her so much as a person. I just didn't understand why we focus so much on David Chang in the middle, because they are putting like the narrative, they're trying to put this narrative that is very neat onto chefs that don't necessarily have it. Mm-hmm. And like, it just doesn't make any sense. I'm like, focus on your amazing work. And if we just talked about the food, and if there is a story coming off of the food, there probably is, because like, learning to be a chef is a really difficult and strange occupation. I think chef stories are amazing, but it's just like, come on, Chef's Table. Like, that's not why we're here. It just bothers me so much. And like, people are so focused on the fact that it looks amazing, and people also love food and chef stories so much that they're like, Eric, why do you hate Chef's Table? And I'm like, I don't. I just think that it bothers me so much and it makes me upset. They also tell them in super neat packages. And this was at a time when I was like, really frustrated. I was in this really shitty job in radio and I wasn't getting any sort of support from like my management team. And this is before we went off to do Multitude, which was Amanda striking out and bringing me along as well and creating this company. The narratives were so pat, it seemed like they had so much support by people who would just be like, yeah, I'll hire you, 22-year-old kid who just moved to New York City. Come on in. And now I'm an executive chef and I have 7 ramen restaurants.
Yeah, it's so easy. You just show up and someone gives you a job and then you become famous the next day.
With the Christina Tosi one, it was like she worked her ass off and she was so smart and she was so good at so many other things that wasn't making pastries. And then David Chang was like, hey, he didn't say bitch, but he might as well said bitch. He was just like, hey, Christina Tosi, make me cookies. And then she did it. And then they were amazing. And they're the basis for the cookies that are now in Milk Bar. And like, that narrative structure of making it seem so pat, like, streamlines everything and then is so strange. Like, there is so much work, and everyone knows this about chef stories, that it's like, yeah, your life sucks until you becoming executive chef. Like, I wish that there was a little more grit there, but everything's so streamlined because it needs to fit into this documentary thing that we're doing here.
I just love how passionate you are about this.
Well, it's a bad structure. The structure isn't serving the story.
I totally get what you're saying. I'm not trying to like dismiss your feelings, but you really truly are passionate about this and I love it.
No, I appreciate y'all hearing me out, because honestly, like, it's hard to, like, people don't listen to me, and this is the most coherent I felt about saying some of this stuff. Being in like a disadvantaged position as I was in a shitty job, and now in a very small company, in an independent podcast collective, you see people succeed, even if there are places that they are very glaring weaknesses that I see. And like, there's no reason for anyone else for them to change because they're already being successful and are reinforced by other capitalist means. Mm-hmm. Like Chef's Table, for example, they're fucking, everyone loves Chef's Table, but it's like, you could make better stories. You could choose chefs that actually have stories. And there are some very, very beautiful stories that they tell. There was one where like a guy, the woman who started La Brea Bakery, it was all about her, how she was wrapped up in her relationship with her husband. And then she split off and like created this whole thing, and it was all about San Francisco and like, and like California, and it was a very beautiful story. And there's some very beautiful stories, like Hero Dreams of Sushi is another really beautiful food story. But it's like, if someone were to tell them to change this stuff, then we're like, hey, we're the like the most popular thing on Netflix, why would I change?
Right.
Because there's no, there are no consequences to doing something poorly because it's successful.
So this is very much a space for us to passionately share our weird pet media opinions. And I, in addition to appreciating your intense feelings about Chef's Table, I also feel that I have been very restrained by not asking you questions about the challenge, which is really all I want to talk to you about.
Let's go.
The challenge. Before we start talking specifically about the challenge, what is your favorite reality competition show?
I think it's a toss-up between The Challenge and Survivor. I watched a lot of seasons of Survivor. I don't really catch up with it that much anymore. Oh, no. What the fuck am I talking about? Survivor is like my legacy pick, but my two are RuPaul's Drag Race and The Challenge.
Staple shows. So your legacy. So have you, like, did you watch Survivor first season? Like when it was, when it first started airing, like when did you get on the Survivor train?
I popped in and out. I don't really remember exactly. I just kind of like the, it was like a thing for such a long time. And then it was another thing. Like you could just watch with your friends and like have strong opinions about it, like bet on if you really wanted to. Like I did a bachelorette fantasy draft for a few years there before it got super stupid. And I stopped watching The Bachelor. Yeah, I think that the newer seasons of Survivor honestly are some of their best because it is like awareness of the game. The people who are playing have kind of like watched every single season of Survivor. People come back. There's a lot of relationship building, and they're also very, very innovative with the games and the rule and the meta game of Survivor as a whole. So it's a lot more about strategy. It's a lot more about like voting each other out, using idols, like using everything at your advantage. I really like the innovation they've been doing over the last few seasons, but it just kind of pop in and out. RuPaul's Drag Race and The Challenger shows that I keep up with immediately. Like I watch within a week, if not the night it airs.
I am also very much remain on top of The Challenge. And you mentioned this idea of like the people being on the show having clearly been fans of the show before they get on the show. And it's one of my favorite things. In the most recent seasons of The Challenge, whenever they do their trivia round, and for people who have not seen this show, there is usually once per season the big challenge is a trivia game. And in recent seasons, the trivia games have been less general trivia and more like challenge trivia. Mm-hmm. And it's hilarious to watch the people who were on the seasons that are being asked about get the questions wrong. And the, you know, 22-year-old who's like, yeah, I remember watching that season when I was 13. I know exactly who won.
Hey, I know who hated who. CT, do you remember when you punched that guy? And CT's like, yeah. No. It's funny, like, Mara, just to set the scene here. So the challenge is a feeder system for what used to be the Real World and Road Rules, two staples of the early 2000s MTV lineup. And now it's kind of just like all MTV reality shows and like some other ones that they just decide to like get people on that Viacom also owns.
Basically, yes.
Yeah. And now it's like a lot of people from the UK, because the UK have been fucking crushing it on their reality shows lately. I've been watching Love Island like nobody's business, which is also a combination, interestingly. Like you can still have a romance reality show like Love Island or Are You the One that also has gameplay, which is like blowing my mind in a totally different way. But so the challenge, there's like this tradition. They've been doing this for so long, and a lot of it is just like you're all in a house and you're all drinking, you all yell at each other. But it's a lot about like eliminating other people, outlasting people. There's a vocabulary that the people use with each other. There's like a power hierarchy. There are traditional villains that come back. There are people who pop up then get woven into the lore. People's like it then becomes like a meta, it's like a fucking ARG because like you have to follow what's happening on social media and because they fucking tweet now, and also what's happening like on the show, and you can compare the two if you want to spoil. When we're talking about spoilers, like, do you want to spoil yourself by looking at their social media because they're like, oh, did Cara Maria get out because now she's tweeting? So like, did she get eliminated early? The relationships they have becomes drama within the house. Like, it's just a lot of stuff happening at the same time. And it's all ratcheted up to 11 because they're like fucking jumping out of planes, and there's always like, and like they're fucking running into each other, and all of these guys are like 100% on steroids.
I have a whole separate Twitter list that it's like a private Twitter list that is people on the challenge. I don't actually want to follow any of these people. Like, I don't want them in my timeline. Like, they're, most of their normal opinions are not good. But I specifically, like, after I watch an episode of the challenge, will then pull up that Twitter list. And like, this increases the pressure to watch it close to when it aired. But it's really funny because the show thrives on those sort of, you know, who hates who and whatever. And it's been wild in the last few seasons to watch Twitter be the basis of, like the enemies. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, oh, we know you two are enemies because screenshots of tweets, bam, bam, bam. You're just like, okay, sure. Yes. This, and like, it is a wild and weird new dimension to the show.
It's also the best part for me is the host. The host is TJ Lavin, the old BMX spiker. And he's so incredibly chill, and he's been hosting the show the entire time.
He is clearly bored out of his fucking mind.
Oh, he's like, so bored. Like,
he's just the last few seasons, especially they have started doing these celebrity. There's like a celebrity kind of spinoff one where people from the challenge play against. First, they play with them against like actual Olympic athletes and stuff, but now it's just like people who are famous from other places. But Mike the Miz Mizanin, a wrestler who used to be on The Real World, like, hosts that. And watching the Miz host, like, this is somebody who's clearly very good at hosting, and then we jump back to TJ hosting the challenge.
They've been breeding the Miz so much because now the Miz does their after shows, like the reunion specials, because TJ, I guess TJ's too busy like having concussions and almost dying, because he still BMX bikes because he has fucking concussions and he almost dies all the time.
And also just like the interpersonal drama that fuels the after show, like TJ clearly cannot be bothered to care about it, and I get it. Like, I get the sense of like, no, these people are adults and like none of their drama makes sense for adults to care about, but also it's your job. So
all right, so Mari, how can I sell this to you?
Well, listen, I used to watch Real World like in its heyday, in its prime, and I watched all of the first seasons of back when it was the Real World Road Rules Challenge, which was always hilarious because the Road Rules people, this
the
is what they
was
did.
Actual challenges.
This is what they, like they were all, and then the Real World people were all like squishy and drunk and would lose a lot. So I don't actually, if I'm going to watch reality TV, it is also going to be competitive, either that or something that I watch because of people. So you mentioned like watching with friends or tweeting about it, fantasy drafts, things like that will definitely pull me in to a reality TV show more than anything else. I just like caught up with the current season of Are You the One because everybody was talking about it.
Oh my God, we need to talk about it. So, Nicole, we talked about your thing. We're going to talk about Mari's thing.
Well, I mean, to be clear, this is also talking about my thing. I'm part of why she started watching
it. Yeah, because she would not stop talking about it.
But yes, let's talk about her thing.
Well, they're tied together because now the challenge is a feeder system for all the MTV shows. Mm-hmm. So Are You the One and X on the Beach people come to the challenge and they're like rookies and they're squishy and they don't have no idea what's going on because it's like everyone's super ripped on the challenge now. But they also like, it's incredibly like regressive. The challenge house is incredibly regressive and everyone yells at each other and everyone's terrible to each other. But this new season of Are You the One is something I'm so excited about and interested in. I also love it though because it's a math problem and it's just like a bunch of drunk bi and pan people who just want to have fun. Yes. Who don't like math?
Well, it's funny too, because I tweeted a couple times about it being a math problem, and everybody keeps responding to my tweet with a link to the math blog. And I'm like, you guys don't get it. Like, I love that the math blog exists, but I don't want, like, that's not what I'm interested in doing. I'm interested in doing the problem. Like, yeah, I don't want to read somebody else solving the problem. This is fun for me because once a week, my friend comes over and we sit on my couch and we yell at these people about how we know the answers to all of their romantic problems. And then after the show is over, we sit down and we do math together.
Amazing.
And that's the thing, is that you're watching them like just want to be drunk and have fun and date everybody all at the same time. But the thing is that it is a math problem. So I'm watching it and they're like, we got to follow our instincts. We got to follow the feelings in our gut. And I'm like, oh my God, you're trying to win money. Follow the math. Like, I don't understand. Just follow the math.
There was a part, I think there was an episode where, like, at the ceremony, Basit was like, are you the strategist? It's are you the one? And I'm like, that's not even a good burn. And yes, right. It is.
It is. Are you the strategist?
Yeah, right. Like, that's ultimately where we're going here. But it's interesting because something that I think the show sort of tries to show you, but just genuinely does not have the space to explore, is how much more, like, built-in complicated it is on an emotional level for this house full of people when they are all at such different places in their coming out journeys.
Yeah.
So for some of these people, like, this is the first time that they have been able to be in an explicitly queer space. This is the first time that they've really been able to, like, be themselves and feel comfortable. And, like, so there's so much else going on there that, like, this show is just, like, it's not built to explore all of that, but it's, like, simmering under the surface. And so even when everybody's being just, like, the messiest of bitches, I am also incredibly sympathetic to that kind of underlying thing. Also, just, like, everyone in this house is really hot, and so, like, you're just attracted to all of these hot people. I don't know. I feel for them.
I feel like a lot of the fuckboy behavior that a lot of the people in the house do would be a lot more grating for me if I was watching the straight one, because, like,
right,
I know them just as, like, a B-level MTV show, and I didn't watch it, and then Amanda was watching it, and I'm like, oh, this is actually incredibly interesting. I super want to watch it. So I like, and also just, like, I don't know, straight people on a romance show on MTV, like, incredible, would be incredibly grating, you know? Like, I can't do that straight up. Like, I'm watching Love Island UK, and I'm, like, charmed by the fact that they're British.
So,
like, that's the twist
there
on
it. There has to be something else, right? Like, some other layer.
I think this was a problem with, I mean, we're talking about the transition of the real world into what this is now. The real world stopped being a good show because they realized they couldn't just, like, have people hang out anymore. Like, it right. needs to be a content in some way, and then they started doing, like, all these, like, adventures and challenges, and then it was, like, super boring, and now the real world is on Facebook Watch, so, like, yes. Bye.
Utterly bewildering to me. I keep getting ads for it.
Yeah, it's like, I don't need people. Like, I have Twitter. I don't have to right. I have, like, our relationships. Like, I have all the drama I need. Like, I don't need just people hanging out. I need a ridiculous island where people have to follow ridiculous rules.
Right, right.
That's honestly what I love about Love Island. I don't know if you've been part of the new craze of Love Island UK, but, like, it's another romance that is kind of straightforward. It's like, people come together, they got to be coupled, and then sometimes they get shifted around. But, like, the fact that they get told at the time that they have to go do these things, and then there are daily episodes, so there's not actually a lot of editing, so you see people reacting in real time to, like, rules and constrictions that the producers, who are unseen except for, like, texts that sometimes they get, they have to react in real time to it. So, like, I'm really loving that. Instead of a board game, it's more like you get dropped into an escape room, and, like, you need to deal with the escape room immediately that you've never seen before.
Going back, I just want to say that the portion of all of this that most sold me on perhaps watching the next season of The Challenge is that the host is, like, super bored and bad at his job. I don't know why that was a thing that I was like, I don't know, I'll check that out.
All right, I'm going to lead. All right, TJ Lavin is everyone's dad because he's older than everyone else now. Uh-huh. And, like, he just hates it when you quit.
Yeah,
like TJ hates quitters.
TJ really hates quitters.
Okay, cool. I'll watch that.
He's been doing it for so long that he's just like, oh, I've seen everyone do everything. Just don't quit. There's a part in the finale of last season where Maddie, who I love, who's from a show called Party Down South, that was on CMT, who I love so much, and she's like over 6 feet tall and she's fucking built. There was a part where they had literally were running through the desert and she just like collapsed and she could not go any farther, and she got like sixth place, which like you don't win any money if you come like below third. And there's a part where TJ, like, they find out she's okay. They come out, TJ comes up to her and is like, Maddie, what happened there? And she's like, I don't know, TJ, I can't do it anymore. And she's like, Maddie, you gotta stop smoking cigarettes and you can get farther next season. She's like, I know, TJ.
Thanks, Dad.
Good advice.
It's a running joke that all of them are stupid and no one knows how to do puzzles. So it's like if there's a combination of like of action and puzzles, like they are so bad at it. There's another like running trope that you're going to do something that is going to be high in the air. You're going to be like 100 feet up above water. And sometimes you might need to jump into the water as punishment because you lose, or you jump into it and you have to swim and it's like going to be very cold. And there are some people who just do not know how to swim.
Yes.
Season after season after season, they never learn how to swim.
They don't think, before I go on this show, I should maybe take a couple quick swimming lessons. Also, just in general, like people's fears of heights and stuff like that, where it's just like this is part of the show. You know, at some point in time, you will be very high. You will have to swim. You will have to eat gross stuff. Like, these are all things that will definitely be asked of you.
Oh my God, the people who can't eat things. Oh my God. I think, last point, and like, there's something about like loving one-dimensional characters that like sometimes you just need someone who's like not very deep. An example for me would be Tony. Tony, he's a terrible, reprehensible human being. He has a dumb fucking face. He's just like a built kind of white guy, and he like has like three different babies and three different mothers just because he like cheated on all of them. So and now he has this thing called Tony time, which is when he gets super amped up and he just like does really well in an eating challenge. So there's this thing where he just ate like a pint of mayonnaise and like everyone's like, oh, Tony, great job. And it's like, you're a terrible person, but like everyone loves you because you can eat things. So I guess this is a thing you're known for. So it's like you root for people in these very narrow, specific characterizations. Like, you love Johnny Bananas because he's a straight up villain and a terrible person.
I do not love Johnny Bananas. Ever since Sarah, I will never forget.
Of course. Yeah. Well, I want to know about the producer that told him to do that. In the one season of The Challenge, it was partners, and then you got to the end and it was like rivals, but you were playing with a partner, and then you got to the final and it was $1 million you could split with your friend, your partner, or you could take on your own. And Johnny and Sarah won, and Johnny took the whole money.
Damn.
Sarah was like one of my favorite players, and she has not been back after. Yeah, this.
Of course not. Like, why no, would you? This.
She was like trying to go to grad school. So it's like you like the archetypes because it's simple, and then when people do something that are surprising or interesting and you can focus on one very specific thing, it really like blooms.
Okay, well, I'm satisfied by the very long amount of time that we got to talk about The Challenge. I feel my heart is full. Before we go, is there something else that you love that you want to recommend? Something that we haven't managed to talk about yet, but if anybody is listening at home and is like, oh man, I love all the things Eric loves, I should go check out something else that Eric loves.
That's good. I'm going to recommend a board game that's going to get people into board games to transcend kind of the monopolies of the world. You should get the game Betrayal on the House on the Hill, and you should get the expansion for it immediately. So Betrayal on the House of the Hill is a really interesting game. Think of it like a horror movie. The first half of the horror movie, you are like one teenage archetype, and you have this little game board that like gives you your little like character sheet that tells you your stats, and you're walking around a spooky mansion, and you can explore things. It's like procedurally generated. You put these tiles down, and that's like the mansion as you walk around. And like you find items and you find like events, and you also find these things called omens, and it triggers this thing called the haunt. And in the second half of the game, you trigger the haunt and it becomes a very specific horror movie. It turns into a new game, a totally new game. So originally it's just like you're kind of playing it however, and then it becomes cooperative. It's everyone against one person. It's every man for himself. And like it becomes a just a totally different monster movie. And you get to like look at this manual that gives you a scenario of a game. So if you buy the expansion, there are 100 different scenarios, some of which were made by some really interesting game designers, some really cool celebrities. Pendleton Ward of Adventure Time made one. Anita Sarkeesian of the feminist games critic came up with one. There's some really interesting people who came up with those games. Betrayal in the House of the Hill pushes you to role play. It makes you think about games in a different sort of way. It is endlessly replayable. You can play it with from 3 to 6 people. The game is different in any sort of way because it depends on like what omen you get and what room you get, so you can trigger all different types of stories. It is amazing and I love to play it.
And on that note, thank you so much to Eric for joining us, and thank you to all of you for listening. If you are enjoying this podcast, we would love it if you consider joining our community on Patreon at patreon.com/snarksquad. We've got some bonus content and polls and other fun stuff. Or if you would rate and review us in Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, we would love to hear all of your thoughts on this episode. Usually I would say the media. I don't know if you have your thoughts on Eric Silver as a person.
If you're super into Chef's Table, come to my Twitter. Come at me.
There will be a post dedicated to this episode up at snarksquad.com, or you can find us on Twitter at snark_squad. I am at Sweeney Says.
You can find me at My Name is Marines.
And you can find me on Twitter at L_Silvero, ELSILVERO. That is my name if I was a Lucha Libre wrestler.
Thank you, as always, to Stefan Jin for the theme music that is playing us out right now. We will be back in your feed again next week. Bye.
Bye.